You were essentially given the keys of the kingdom, and you could pretty much do whatever you wanted. There was trust that everybody was there. The mission was very clear. The problem isn't the idea. The problem is choosing, you know, which one you focus on. It starts with being purpose-driven. Like, the Google was all about making the world a better place.
Hey, leader of the pack. Hey, dear leader, it's a great pleasure to have you again here on the show, to have you on today's Lightwolf podcast with an exceptional leader who spent a significant part of his professional career in a wonderful company named Google. It's my huge pleasure to welcome today former CEO and former 15-year Google leader, Eric Tolomei. Dear Eric, a huge warm welcome to the Lightwolf podcast.
Good morning, everyone. Great to be here.
It's awesome that you're here. And I'm really honored that you're giving all of us and the Lightwolf community some of your precious time. As those people here on the call who have been here a couple of times already know, and for those who are new today, for the first time joining the show, the purpose of our team and our company and the purpose of this podcast is to help create a well-led world. And one of the ingredients is learning from great leaders like you, Eric. That's why I really feel honored and humbled that you're here today. For you folks out there listening, Eric enjoys a tremendous professional career with many years in one of the most successful businesses in the history of mankind. It's Google, a company that within less than 20 years became a verb in literally every single language on the planet. Eric himself, a Stanford graduate, had his first professional experience at Handspring and Palm. And then Eric had 15 years at Google, worked in Switzerland, and was the first ever product manager at Google promoted to director outside the United States. Eric launched YouTube internationally in 10 countries. After 2 years at Google in the Silicon Valley, Eric had co-responsibility for the entire Zurich site, which is the largest engineering site outside the United States with more than 2,200 engineers at the time. And Eric built one of the largest and most successful Google teams in that office focused on Google Shopping. In 2017, Eric left shortly, became the CEO of internet company 1&1 Jonas, and then returned to Google in 2019 to work on Google Maps. And now plans the next chapter of his highly accomplished and exciting professional career. Eric, you are a passionate product builder, an outstanding leader, both key to making the world a better place. It's a huge pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Super excited to talk about making the world a better place through innovation. That's been, as you sort of highlighted, my life. So
let's zoom into a couple of starting questions. Listening to you as a human, Eric, what inspires you?
I guess maybe that's very literal in terms of being inspired, but it's human creativity and far less my own than everybody else's. Like, I'm always impressed. You know, it's easy to wake up when you see how much is going on in the world to think everything's been done and invented already and created. And yet, and I think things like, you know, platforms like YouTube and Instagram, et cetera, like I've helped sort of distribute more of this, but like, every morning in one of my streams somewhere, there's some human doing something very simple, right? With hands and gestures or, you know, colors. And it's beautiful. It's innovative. It's creative. It's new. And you've never seen it before. And I think, I guess it's also what distinguishes us as a species from many others. But like, I find that inspiring, basically. The fact that there's always room for something new. And I'm just amazed.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. So human creativity. And my podcast manager, Hannah, in fact, a wonderful human being, great to have her on the team, 6 years ago asked me, and I went like, wow, what a great question. So let me ask you, what is a perfect day for you?
I think a perfect day for me is I can spend 12 hours working on, you know, projects I love to, you know, make the world better as often as possible. 12 hours of quality family time, 12 hours for myself, and 8 hours of sleep. So I'll let you figure out what's wrong with that perfect day. But that's my perfect day. And you know what I mean, basically. Like, time is the most precious resource here.
Yeah, you're so right. Yeah, me too. Whenever I applied to God to please prolong the day to 48 hours, I haven't ever received a response. So we share another passion.
Well, there's the thing about going west, right? Where you can have longer days, but it only works for so long. So
yeah, it only works for so long until it catches you up. I agree. Yeah. Starting to talk about the professional side of your life, Eric, when you joined Google, was that in 2007-ish?
Seven, yeah.
So yeah, 2007. Yeah. How did you perceive Google's culture at that time?
I mean, in one word, it was amazing. I was coming from another Silicon Valley company, a much smaller one. And so, you know, I'd sort of already been acquainted with, you know, companies where you work with smart people, it's agile, et cetera. But like at Google, there was a lot more to it. I think there was all of the above, obviously. But, you know, I also discovered, I think maybe the most, I don't know, they were all striking. The most striking thing maybe was empowerment. I think every company you join, you know, they'll tell you, and here you are empowered. And I don't think they don't really even know what they mean until, you know, you get to a place like Google where, and it was extreme at the time because there was very little, you know, top-down management. You were essentially given the keys of the kingdom. Here's a role. Even the role isn't very well defined, and the company was growing so fast that you just make your role as you live through the day. And you could pretty much do whatever you wanted. There was trust that everybody was there. The mission was very clear. That was very powerful. And so people were aligned to the mission, and then, you know, take a problem and go solve it. And I was a team lead already. So use your teams to the best ability, their ability. And similarly, right, not about constraining them, but like, let's just rally behind a bigger goal. And so it was amazing. And it stayed like that for very long. I think that's one of the huge things. I discovered also extreme openness and honesty. I think that ability to trust people, be trusted, be, and if things go wrong, be able to say it. You know, all this was very powerful. There were no politics in the traditional sense of the word politics in companies, right? It was just all of us working together, swimming in similar directions. You know, I also discovered launch and iterate. I previously worked in hardware companies. So, you know, you got to be careful. You have a supply chain, and if you make a mistake and 100% of your products come back, it hurts. But it was the first time I was working on the web, on the internet. And there, the idea that, you know, you launch something, you experiment, you iterate, that's just, you know, extremely exciting when you're trying to build products. I think the last thing I'd mention is also, you know, it was the famous motto, don't be evil. You know, lots of people have said lots of things about it, but it was very genuinely true. And these impeccable ethics, basically, and just the fact that the company was run first and foremost for its mission to organize the world's information, not to make money. That was and still is a privilege. Like, it, you know, everybody was thinking about how to accomplish the mission. And then money was a byproduct of having stumbled on a great business case, which was very convenient. And, you know, I think we were very lucky. But that ability to just rally behind a goal, I guess is what we talk about, you know, purpose-driven organizations, that was extreme at Google. And for me, as a fairly young person learning in an environment like this, you know, all the factors I've just mentioned were mind-boggling.
Yeah. And it completely resonates with me, Eric. Here I have the photo that I took when I was at Google Zurich about a year ago, when last February you were kind enough to invite me and to have a little visit. What you share is what I felt. And I'm, of course, a complete newcomer and external to Google, using your product every day, of course, but that's what I felt as well. And similarly, I had the pleasure last November to also see two more Google offices over in Manhattan. with a young man named Lucas, who also will have a snippet here in the show later on. And I felt the same. So when I think about the words you use, the words that are often used in leadership contexts in many companies today, words like empowerment, openness, and honesty, and extreme honesty, I saw it, I feel it, and it seems to be really a distinguishing factor of the Google company. Yeah. Now, when listening to this and also feeling you right now, how you talk about this experience, what made you leave Google and what made you return?
So I left, and I didn't leave because I was tired of Google, basically. I left, when you work at Google, you get a job offer every week, which is a very fortunate place to be. And many of them are nowhere comparable to, what we could do and achieve and build at Google. But, this came at a time when first I'd been growing that team and product Google Shopping for 5 years. So there was a bit of a feeling of being there, done it, what's next. But also that company was looking for a product-minded CEO to sort of revive them. And it felt to me like, when you've spent 10 years in an environment like the one I just described, which was very aligned with my own values and skills, you sort of want to distribute this. You want to, you want to help others get to that sort of holy grail of how you'd like a company to work. And so when they offered me the role of CEO and basically say, can you make us more like Google? The company was exciting, the people running it, the founders basically, and the VC, the private equity that was involved were entrepreneurs. So they understood what it takes to change companies, et cetera. It just felt like a very unique opportunity to try and accelerate a good company into a great company by bringing some of what I really learned and I had in myself basically to them. So that's what was exciting. Also, the fact that I always sell, my life has been product management, and I always sell the role of product management as you're the CEO of the product, essentially. And so, and I've always wondered how true that is, right? Because I've always been a product manager. And so I was quite attracted to the sort of GM CEO type roles and see, well, let's go, this is a company giving me the chance to try that and see how good of a CEO I can be. And so all of this made it super exciting. And this is why, I didn't leave Google because I was tired of Google, but because this felt like a unique opportunity for me to validate, can I be a CEO, bring the value I thought I could bring to a company that needed it, create, like a mini Google, out of an already very good company, in Europe. And so all this just sounded very exciting. And it was very exciting. It was an incredible adventure. So that's what took me out of Google. Eventually came, the time to move on. And if you asked me before, I would have never, ever said I'll work twice for the same company in my whole life. Life is too short. Like, I'm the sort of person that never goes back in the same place on vacation because, we had great time in place X or Y, but like, there's so many other things in the world. I want to go discover other things, right? So I never, ever thought I would come back to the same company. But at the time, I wanted to work in Zurich. In my field, that sort of constrains the problem space in terms of jobs you can find. And I did look for another job, found three exciting things, but, it was 2019. So 12 years after I joined Google, it still felt that, for all the reasons I mentioned before, essentially the Google culture, the people there, this was by far the best opportunity. And I think it was. And so that's what brought me back to Google, excited to work on a product I loved and I hadn't worked on, Google Maps. So there you go. I came back to Google. And by the way, this is common. There are people, what we count at Google is how many times you've come back. So some people have come back three times. I don't know if somebody's come back four times, but really not unique and nowhere near a record by having come back to Google.
Oh, wow. I didn't know. Amazing. I mean, I'm so it's opportunity and development interest that kind of intrigued you ways.
Yeah, and it was very much
leaving and coming.
Yeah, it was, and suddenly the jump to that CEO role as much of a personal development opportunity as an opportunity to bring to that company so much that I thought I could bring to them, basically. And I was just chatting actually with the venture capital person that was, the private equity person that was my primary contact when I was the CEO there, René Obermann. He's the ex T-Mobile CEO, if you know him.
Yeah.
You do.
Yeah, I do.
You know, I was chatting with him over New Year, and he was saying, you know, there's still some people who talk to him about, you know, the cultural aspects in particular that I brought to one and one Ionos at the time. It's interesting how the culture often feels fluffy, and you know, people are far more down into, okay, we need to unify platforms and teams and X and Y, and culture feels like this fluffy thing that you can always postpone or isn't that important. But in the end, I actually think, and I think they are seeing now, that what lasts and what really makes it a lasting difference and an important difference is actually that sort of culture. This, if you can create environments like the one I described we have at Google, I think you're setting yourself up for lasting, you know, increased chances of success, I'd say.
Yeah. You just touched upon an individual who connects you and me. And it's when we met Eric, whatever, more than a year ago, we both discovered that René Obermann is a gentleman who I continue to admire. A wonderful man, a huge entrepreneur, extremely charismatic, very inspiring. And although I doubt it, when I left P&G joining T-Mobile, I doubt it. He was the one who made me buy in and who made me join. So it was the same individual that made you and me leave long-standing careers in strong companies. Now, when I connect this to culture, and we will come back to culture a couple of times in this chat, Eric, let's do one first digression into one aspect of culture. Listening to my friends who work in the personnel recruitment space, looking for people like you, highly accomplished leader, and seeing whether they might be interested in joining other companies, headhunting, personnel recruitment. What I'm learning is that the biggest factor determining success of the change is culture fit. Yeah. And the question that maybe some here on the call would be really interested in is to learn from you about the moment when you left Google and you joined that new opportunity, when you joined the company Ionos. To what extent could you feel that culture that you were entering, and what came the way you expected it, and what didn't? Were there any surprises in your new role?
It's a very interesting question. So the situation was a little, I guess, different from, or not, from a different, for a normal situation. I was hired to bring this sort of Google way of doing things. So in many ways, they didn't express it as like, please change our culture, but that's pretty much what it was. And so in some ways, you know, I arrived in this space where I had met some people, mostly the, you know, some of the leaders there, but not too many people. And I didn't know actually what the true culture was. And there's, of course, you know, what the leaders or what the books say and the reality. So that was a leap of faith I took there. But it turned out that, you know, it was a fairly traditional culture, I'd say, but the people were good. And it was, you know, a lot of fairly young people, you know, very, very eager to do well. And so in many ways they were, and of course, when you come with a Google label stuck on your forefront, you know, it was easy for me. And so I think in many ways, this is a case where I was there to sort of bring fresh air into the culture and shift it. And people were, you know, 90% of them were super excited by going down that path. So this was a very unique moment where I didn't feel I had to adapt to the culture. It was more like, can they do it? How far are they today? But there was a lot of eagerness to sort of follow me. And so that was, I'd say, easy. Though, you know, we go down into lots of interesting conversations when I started introducing some things like real empowerment, because this was a company where decisions tended to go up and up and up. And when I said, no, decisions have to be done at the right level. And so sometimes you're not going to make the decision, Mr. Vice President. You're going to tell, you know, the person under you that they make the decision. There was a lot of, you know, it's not just cultural. So how do we do this? Like, it changes the relationship. So I wouldn't say it was easy, but at least I felt this was a clear mission and a doable one. But the other side, I'd say, is like, I also had a board In fact, there was all the CXOs who were my peers as well as our supervisory board. And there, these people hired me to be, you know, to bring that sort of fresh air and create a new brand, et cetera. But they, you know, they were a different generation, different, brought up in different context. And so I think that's where maybe I had underestimated their understanding and appreciation of what it means to change a culture and what the new culture should be. And I'd actually summarize it as this is what ended up being the reason I left eventually, is that, you know, we thought we were aligned on what we were creating, but as we got closer to some very hard decisions that I felt were needed to really drive that new culture and new brand and new this and new that, you know, cold feet came out of the woods here and there. So I think in many ways, this was an interesting sort of split image, if you wish, of, you know, under me, a whole company eager to embrace a new culture that I was representing, though it wasn't always easy, but that was, you know, a clear direction that people still talk about today as a positive thing. But around and above me, a set of people who in theory knew they wanted something different, but actually weren't necessarily prepared and struggled with it. So there you go.
Yep. Brilliant. Let's zoom into this one a little more, because it's at the heart of one of the systemic changes in the business world and in leadership. The world that my father grew up in was a top-down management world, very hierarchical. Leadership just had one direction, top down. The knowledge was pooled at the very top. Information was shared very selectively. It was like a monopoly of knowledge at the very top. And people in the middle or in the lower parts of an organization were also used to being told what to do rather than being invited to think what's right. So this is the old model. And I think in the time when it was invented, like in post-World War II times, when industrial companies came up, it had its justification to be the way it was. Now, contrast that with the new and contemporary way of leading, where leadership is not top-down, but 360 degrees. First and foremost, you lead yourself, then you lead your boss, then you lead people around you, and then hopefully you are being led well by these folks as well. And that is a massive change, just as you describe it. And you just succinctly articulated the two of the, maybe more, but two clear frontiers and areas of moving change. One is working upwards in an organization that invites you to come and bring evolution and bring change. And the other one is the people wanting to follow you, and people also like middle managers who learned from you to not take a decision themselves, but to delegate the decision, maybe for the first time in their lives, to the people in their teams. Yeah. So let's go these two directions and explore this a bit, Eric, because this is pure gold. If you think back about the way how you led your board, your superiors, what have you learned in terms of what works in managing, leading senior stakeholders above you when you want to bring about change?
I have a very equalitarian view of leadership, where I'm going to say in different words, I think more or less what you said, but like in my mind, I am a believer of organizations. You know, you have some companies that try to run without even an org chart or anything like this. Maybe I just haven't seen the light yet, and I need to work in one of these to realize how awesome it is. Personally, I feel, you know, when you're trying to accomplish something, you know, where the sum is greater than the parts, you need some sort of structure and functions and so on, and therefore management layers and so on. So I think that's, you know, that's a good thing personally. But then I see an organization, think of it like a molecule, where, you know, we have bonds with peers, management above us, and people under us. And in many, you know, places now, with all the different matrices at stake, you have more than one manager as well, right? It's not just this sort of pyramidal shape. And my sense is we all have, where we are, we have a vantage point. We have a unique view. It's one thing I used to tell people who joined Google. When you join Google, even when I joined in 2007, it was already a pretty successful company. It was scary to join. And when you join now, it's like, there's so much knowledge accumulated. How am I ever going to be able to catch up and make a difference? And I'm always telling people, but your job in the company is unique. And so you're going to create a point of view, a vantage point that only you have. And very quickly, you'll be the expert at what your role there. But then what I try to do myself and appreciate from others is like, then it's interactions like the atoms and the molecule with peers upstairs, downstairs, sideways, where you exchange views and ideas. And whether it's super short term to solve an urgent problem or a super long term strategy, I think it's through these communications that the future gels. It's all these interactions, these decisions you make that basically create both the strategy, the roadmap, the plans, and solve the problems. And if you think of it that way, we're all leading, just as you said, right? You're leading, people above you, you're leading your peers, you're leading, people in your team, but you're 50% leading, you're 50% being led. It's basically exchanges. And your leadership is the leadership of your vantage point, because that's where you're the expert. You're the only person who has that function and understands this as good as and better than anybody else. So that's what you sort of radiate around yourself to all these contact points you have. And you expect the same from all the other people. And this is how you get to that sort of better knowledge, better decision, better actions and everything. So that's sort of like my super, I guess, equalitarian view of leadership. And maybe one thing I'd stress is, as I said, it's 50-50, which is you're as much leading as you're being led. And that means you're an active listener. And I think, people closer to the top tend to not always be as good as they should as active listening, though I think the strongest ones actually are great active listeners. But you can also be at the bottom of the pyramid and not be a great active listener. So I think that's a whole other dimension of this works best if people are truly capable of receiving as much as they are giving and leading.
Yeah, awesome. Brilliant. Great insights. If you think about the people you met in that organization who were not used to delegating decisions downward, how did you help them start doing it successfully?
I think so. That's a good question. First of all, there's an element of convincing them it's the right thing, because when it's uncomfortable, people tend to retreat to what seemed to work well before. So there's a lot of education, like discussions like the one we're having now of why this is better and how this would work. Another key element for me is leading by example. I think if when I did it to them, because before I told them to do it to their people, right, I was doing it to them, right? They'd come to me with a question and I'd say, well, what do you think the answer should be and why? And I was challenging them and helping them think it through, but ultimately it was their decision. I'm basically giving them, besides running it the way I think it should be run, I'm also giving them examples and demonstrations of how you do this in real life, basically. So I think it's, you can call it coaching or teaching by example, but it was very much just practicing it, with them. And sometimes people just pick it up because they just see it and they're smart and they say, oh, okay, that's the sort of questions you do, the attitude you have, and they do it naturally. Some other people, they need to be more told more explicitly, right? It's not enough to just do it. You have to sort of vocalize that you're doing it. So I would say, look, when we had that conversation, remember, I didn't make the decision. I asked you what you would do and I told you, well, then do it, right? I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but that's the spirit basically of I think in many cases, just, leading from the top from a cultural standpoint is just, do what you say what you do, I guess. And sometimes be extra explicit about the fact that you are, doing it that way for a purpose, and then helping them replicate this. Now, sometimes you go into more details. If they're really struggling with a particular person or a particular topic, you can go and spend some time just sort of analyzing this and being a little more precise and explicit about things. But in general, I'd say mostly the lead by example basically was the primary recipe.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Okay, dear LightWolf community, it's my huge pleasure to now introduce to you Lukas Geiger, customer engineer at Google Cloud. And we are talking here in New York, Manhattan. Dear Lukas, it's a pleasure to welcome you here on the call with the Lightwolf community on literally all five continents.
Thank you for having me.
And it's a huge pleasure to be your guest. Guys, for you to know, I've just been toured around and learned a couple of just fantastic things from Lukas, who's working here. And my question to you, Lukas, is a simple one, yet a profound one, and perfectly fits to the title of this podcast. So my question is, what makes the Google culture special to you, Lukas?
Yeah, so first of all, it was a pleasure having you here. Always enjoy your company and your advice. So, you know, they're the obvious things like the free food, you know, the space that we're in, or the people even. But to me, what has kind of sustained throughout my career here, I've been here for about 2 years now, is the autonomy that we receive. I'll give you an example. So as working in a sales organization, we of course do forecasting, and we have this forecasting tool that is well known to not work great. And a lot of people don't enjoy using it, but me and a couple other folks didn't really accept that. And we wanted to build something that we actually enjoyed using. And the problem was that, you know, we'd be on these like sales calls with customers and we'd need insights fast. Like they would often ask, you know, how much are we spending on a certain product? And, you know, I'd have to wait for this stupid tool to load. And by that point, the moment was gone and like the conversation continued. So that was really, really annoying. So what we did is instead of using this tool, we were allowed to have access to hardware, specifically SSDs, that made this process faster. So, yeah, and having the autonomy to not only have access to hardware that costs money to Google, but also have the ability to program freely using tools that other people made at the company previously to us was really a pleasure. So I think that's one of the things that I really like about the culture here.
And what did this do to the final solution, to the product? How did this help you?
Well, now I can, it's just a lot faster and I can gain insights easier. So like, I'll give you an example. The example I gave before was, you know, how much do I spend on this product? Or even like, what is my customer doing in their environment, in their cloud environment? I can now, through this new tool, I can now create these alerts that come to my inbox every single day and say, hey, there's a 10% deviation from this specific product in this specific customer. And I can then either act on it or surface it up to leadership saying, hey, we need to forecast higher or we need to forecast lower for the quarter.
Brilliant. What a brilliant tool that I bet many companies in the world would crave to have. And what a great example of what makes the Google culture special to you. Thank you very much, dear Lukas Geiger.
Thank you.
Let's turn towards another field that I know you're passionate about and that's important for the world. It's innovation. In one of our previous conversations, I heard you say things like, ideas are overrated. Say a bit more to this.
Well, I think it's Thomas Edison, I think. I'm not sure who said, you know.
Did he?
He didn't say that, but he said innovation is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration or something like this.
Yeah.
I think most people who are not in a role where you innovate, and by the way, I'd argue everybody should be in a role, you know, every job, there's something where you can do things better, et cetera. So that's a whole other discussion. But anyway, if you're not in like in say R&D or some place where you're creating the future, people assume it's all about the ideas, right? When you're young in a company, you know, and you're a student and you want to maybe think, do a startup, like you're looking for the idea. Like the idea is, I think, you know, in common culture is the magic thing that creates innovation. And I've never been in a company where we are lacking ideas of what to do next. The problem isn't ideas. Like between strategies that sort of give you a direction, customer feedback, employee suggestions, competitors' moves, etc., there's usually far too many ideas. The problem isn't the idea. The problem is choosing, you know, which one you focus on, because if you, you know, you're never going to be able to do all the ideas, but even if you do like 10 of them in parallel, this isn't going to work. Usually you can afford to do 1, 2, 3 in parallel. I mean, it depends on what scale we're talking about, but you have to pick the right ones. And more importantly, you know, at the end of the day, an idea is only an idea until you have people working on it and creating something, a product, a service out of it, right? A piece of art, et cetera. And people who are skilled to do this is usually the bottleneck. And so having people capable of turning ideas into something that actually works, that's what's hard. And it's also, you know, not only do you need skilled people at just their craft, but actually, like, I've working at Google, I've met a bunch of founders of successful and not successful, you know, startups, et cetera. We hire a lot of people who've created companies. I acquired a few companies, you know, in the name of Google myself. I was very close to the YouTube founders back in the day when I launched YouTube in the world. You know, YouTube didn't start as a public video sharing site. They started with a completely, well, fairly different idea, but it wasn't working. And it's through launching and iterating, back to what we discussed, you know, some minutes ago, that they realized what actually works. And that skill of being able to start with an idea and iterating until you find that sort of market fit, basically, is pretty rare. And you have to have this discipline of, you can't constantly change direction, otherwise you get nowhere, but you can't be too stubborn, otherwise you get nowhere either. And so that fine trade-off about, you know, when you change course, when you don't, what, you know, smelling where the opportunity seems better, and basically turning an idea into a success, not just a working product, but actually ultimately a success. That's what innovation is about. And that's, you know, how the ideas are cheap. That's not the issue.
I love it. Great ideas. We touched upon the topic of importance of customers and consumers. You touched upon it. How does Google live customer centricity?
I think so. In general, you know, it will depend on teams, and most Google teams don't have customers; they have users. First of all, because like there's a lot of places where it's not even really a customer. But to more meaningfully, I think it starts with being purpose-driven, as I mentioned some minutes ago, right? Like Google was all about making the world a better place. And that's also, the world is the people on this planet. And so I think at the heart of the mission, it's about the user. It's not about making money or about corporate success or shareholder value, et cetera. So when you start with such a powerful mission and purpose, and it is true. Like I've been in many companies where most people can't even recite the mission of the company, let alone care. At Google, when I joined, and I think, Google's gotten very big. So things have evolved a little bit, but it's still much better than average, I'd say. But like suddenly, you know, in 2007, everybody knew the mission. Everybody was focused on the mission. And, you know, doing the right thing for the user was sort of a subtitle of the mission. So it was just ingrained. It was ingrained at every level of the company. And it manifested itself in the sense that, you know, also in a meeting, if ever it felt like the meeting was drifting along, you know, a direction that wasn't in the interest of the user, you can be sure someone at one point would bring it up and say, look, you know, it's a hard decision, but like, between these two, there's one that's much better for the user. So that's the one we're doing. And there would be essentially no opposition, basically. So I guess, interestingly, it brings us back to culture and purpose and how the culture truly is the culture, not a theory, and people living the culture.
Yeah, great. We touched upon leadership as well. It's a big topic, complex. You already shared some of your belief on leadership. If you summarized leadership in just a few words, which are yours?
If you really boil it down, and this is, I guess, very generic at this point, but I think there's, I want to say, exciting. Like you got to get people excited. You know, you can call it inspiring or charisma or something like this, but like you got to get people energized. And so I think there's an element of that energy that you need to have, convey and find and trigger in people that is fundamental. Otherwise, you know, nothing goes anywhere. Another aspect to bring up, I guess it's related to the purpose-driven, I think it's ethics. Like I was lucky to land in a company, in multiple companies where the ethics were impeccable. And to me, that's needed. Like the idea that you could lie to a customer, for instance, because that's in the company's interest. Like I couldn't sleep. I couldn't live with that, you know, and I'm assuming that happens in some companies. I could not sort of live in that sort of world, basically. And so I think impeccable ethics, and I think that's where the world is headed, by the way. I think that a younger generation has much more of an expectation that, you know, we're doing the right thing and so on, than necessarily, you know, focus on shareholder value or whatever. So I'd say ethics maybe comes second. And third, I think I'm just going to reuse what I was saying some time ago, which is this sort of equalitarian version of leadership. Yeah, I think so. It's funny, it's all E's, basically. Exciting, ethical, and equalitarian. You know, bring excitement, doing with impeccable ethics, and, you know, provide, you know, create a leadership that is not about top-down or bottom-up, but about we're all here to play a role and let's play it all well together.
Yeah, awesome. I love it. Let's talk about teams, which is on the one hand side hugely relevant to the people on this call, listening to leadership input from you. It also happens to be a passion topic of mine. I love helping teams be successful. And a couple of years ago, there was a stunning study under the name Project Aristotle, done at Google. I think they and a young woman with a few colleagues collected data from about 180 teams in Google, very data rich, of course, and analyzed what makes the difference between highly successful and less successful teams at Google. So you, having lived in that environment, you probably have a unique view on what makes teams successful. Would you mind sharing it?
So I know exactly the study you're talking about. I think it had a different name internally, but anyway, it doesn't matter. But the study came out saying psychological safety, if I remember, is what really distinguishes successful teams from others. And I remember first hearing about this internally and thinking, that's kind of weird. I would have said other things and, you know, like good leadership or good vision or whatever. But like, I think I've actually come around and felt it makes sense, because I think it touches on some of the cultural aspects we discussed before, which is, you know, if people have the ability to be honest without being judged, have the ability to talk about mistakes, fears, first, you know, I think it creates an environment where people are much happier. And, you know, if you're happier to be at work and be with your colleagues, no doubt this has impact on, you know, the team's overall happiness and throughput, et cetera. But also professionally, you know, it's critical to be able to understand the fears and the mistakes and all of this. This is how you learn as a team, you know, how to do things better. Like there is a big culture of Google called the blameless postmortem, which is this ability when something goes wrong to actually, you know, go deep. And people aren't trained to cover their backs and so on, because if that's the case, you don't know what went wrong. So, you know, all this is really important. So I think, you know, I do think ultimately this is what makes some of the, you know, there's plenty of things that make team more or less successful, but that ability to really talk openly, it's also back to this equalitarian vision of leadership, right? You want every voice at the table, you know, even if someone, you know, has, you know, is shy, they might be super good at spotting X or Y or Z. And if you don't give them a voice at the table because it's only the loud people who talk, you're missing out on opportunities to see problems early or have ideas early, et cetera. So, you know, it's all variants of the same idea, but I think there's a lot of truth there about saying that, you know, the more you can create this sort of open, friendly culture where people feel psychologically safe to bring up whatever they want, I think the better. I'll tell you, like, you know, inequality pushed to an extreme becomes a weakness. I think at Google, we went down the path where you might have heard it out externally, but like, you know, bring your whole self to work, you know, it became like you can be who you want, and which is great in theory, but it got into huge political, religious arguments. This is not unique at Google. I think, you know, in the US is very polarized these days, unfortunately, I think.
Yeah.
But so, you know, I think there was a point where it was like, There's a fine line between that psychological safety and bringing constant conflict about things that are not super relevant for work. So I think that's where there's a super subtle line that needs to be drawn about, where that sort of ability to be open and honest starts and stops. But in general, I think, yes, that's powerful. That also brings me to active listening, just that ability to listen to people. Maybe we'll talk more about it in a minute, but it's a skill. I thought I knew how to listen, but I've learned it, and it's so powerful. And that's part, I think, of how you create, it's an element of that psychological safety. It's just being able to listen to people.
I could not agree more. Thank you for bringing this up, Eric. Let's spend a moment on this. I think some people still tend to believe that good leadership is mainly about good talking. I think you and I agree that it's different. And yes, at times you got to talk, and you better make sure that what you say is relevant and precise and succinct. And the way you do it is giving people energy. But I completely agree with you that more often than not, the better way to lead is by leading with your ears. So when you say you've learned how to listen, how did that happen?
Maybe it's the gray hair on the side. It's just,
it's platinum, not gray, platinum.
various trainings here and there that sort of instill these things, role modeling as well. I think it's, conversations with peers, but, I'll give you a very concrete example. When I remember distinctively, I first started as an engineer, I was coding, and then I moved to product management where I talked to customers. And I was often called to present the new product I was building to potential or existing customers. And there I had my presentation ready and everything I wanted to say. And I was hoping I'd run out of time so I wouldn't have any questions, because I was scared of questions, right? I wouldn't have the answers. I would not look good and so on. And it took me a few years to realize how wrong this is. And initially, it's a normal reaction. When questions came, instead of being the perfect question that I knew the answer of, often they were like, oh my gosh, they did not even understand what I was saying, or, oh, but they are clearly were the wrong product. Like, why are they talking to us? And boy, this is extremely valuable. You want to know that they did not understand what you said, because clearly it's your problem. You should have said it a different way. You want to understand that they're looking for some slightly different product, because maybe that's a direction you want to take. And so all of these questions that I feared, because I just wanted to be able to answer them, I grew up to understanding that that's where the gold mine is. It is the questions, that actually get you to understand what it's in these other people's mind that you're trying to convince of something. So I guess that's one super concrete example. But maybe another way to crystallize what you were asking for, which is how did you figure out? I remember reading, I think it was maybe a Quora thing about this, but like there was some random person saying, when I discuss with others, my goal isn't to convince them that I'm right. My goal is to truly understand their point of view, giving them the benefit of the doubt, and even if I'm skeptical, I'm just going to listen, right? And that opened my eyes. Like, I think in most conversations I used to go in where I was very focused, I was listening, I thought, right? But I was listening to you so I could undermine your point of view, so I could defend mine, right? It's a very specific mindset that I think is typical, but you can go into a conversation with a different mindset, which is, I truly want to understand you. You're a smart person. There's a reason, you're thinking that way. Help me understand. And you can think of it even selfishly, right? Like, maybe you're not so smart, but if I'm talking, you're my customer or you're something, right? I need to understand you. I need to understand what's in your brain, possibly even to convince you still. The goal might still be the same, but I'm going to be much smarter about how I can convince you in what I do, what I say, if I truly understand what's going through your brain, basically. So I think that's the eye-opening thing to me, which is like, understanding what others are saying is always extremely valuable, whatever your goal is.
Yeah, awesome. Another topic that's daily business for all these Lightwolf audience here on the call is decisions, taking decisions. How do you take decisions?
Ooh. If I'm tongue in cheek, I'd say making the decision is the easy and fast part, right? It takes seconds. You have these three options and we're going to do A. I think it's everything that's before and after that is hard and often neglected and makes all the difference. I've lived my entire life. I'm often perceived as slow when it comes to decision. And, you know, I don't know, maybe it is a weakness of mine, but I've seen people admired for, oh, they're fast decision makers, but I've seen these decisions not stick or not power through, right? So I tend to think, you know, decision is an important moment where you have lots of people working and they stop to sort of make a decision, they're going to go back to work. And so this is a precious moment where you have a disproportionate chance to change the course of wherever teams, companies are going for the better or the worse. And so, I mean, we could spend hours on this, but I think if I had, maybe just to sort of highlight what I mean by this is a complex space, I think it starts by realizing a decision needs to be made. Lots of people are on autopilot. They don't even realize, hey, you could be making a different decision there, right? So that's yeah. Like step one, is there even a decision to be made? Is it the right time? You have the opposite. Some people are paralyzed by decision-making as in like they question things every time, right? It's like, no, we've made a decision. This is back to my point about knowing when to be stubborn, knowing when to not be too stubborn, right? Like you, so is it the right time to make a decision? Figure out who is the right decision maker. You know, it's not always the boss. Back to my equalitarian vision of organization, it's the person who's with the best vantage point. For in general, there is someone who's the better person. You have to have a culture where you accept that you're going to choose a decision maker based on who's the right person, as opposed to my boss or me or whatever, right? Who are the stakeholders? A decision usually, you know, there's a few close people who are in an org. It'll be usually the peers, reports, managers, like people around that decision maker that probably need to be part of the forming of the decision. What information do we need? Go get the info. You know, have the stakeholder debate the info. Ideally, have the stakeholder propose a decision. I think it's better if there's, you know, or an options, I should say, right? And then, yes, you have that split second where a decision maker will make the decision, but also what happens after, right? The decision maker has to explain the rationale. It's not about a compromise. It's not making everyone happy. It's rarely possible and rarely the right answer. It's what is the right decision? Making sure it's communicated to everybody who needs to know. Often decisions stay in this sort of dark pot and, you know, aren't shared. Share the rationale. People get behind decision, even if they disagree, if they understand why. If people felt they've been listened to and understand the rationale, in most cases, they get behind it. Last thing is that I think it's the classic Jeff Bezos quote, right? It's like disagree and commit. You have to have a culture where, okay, I get it. It was not my preference, but I understand and I will disagree, but I will commit. Decisions getting undermined by all the people that disagreed with it just is a really bad culture and it doesn't get anywhere. And as I said, that was the last thing. I think it's probably the one bad last thing. The very last thing I'd say, you need some sort of healthy escalation process. My benchmark is one every 10 to 20 decisions is probably truly wrong and needs to be revisited. Something went wrong in the decision process. If you never have an escalation, then it's suspect to me. It probably means you have too much of a top-down culture and people don't dare question decisions. One day this will bite you. But if you reopen every other decision, you get nowhere either. And so I think there's a healthy ratio, which I say is about 1 in 10, where there's got to be a very healthy opportunity for people to say, no, this one is not a disagree and commit. This is a not over my dead body. This is wrong. Here's why. And then you can reopen the decision. So that was a long answer. And that's a very short version of, I think, you know, what it means to make good decisions. But that's my way of thinking about it.
Brilliant. And yes, maybe one day we'll have another one on that topic alone, because you're right. It's a complex one, but you touched on some gold, Eric. Thank you very much for doing so. I know also from our previous conversations that the topic of culture is precious to you. It matters to you. And you have articulated to me an outline of a term you call the perfect culture. What is the perfect culture to you?
I think so. A lot of the elements we touched on, I think, are in there, right? It is this sort of equalitarian culture, openness. We never talked about speed, but I think there's a in doubt, move fast, I think is for excitement because time is not standing still and so on. So I think it's a lot of, in many ways, it's a lot of what I've experienced at Google. I'd also be careful to say, I don't know about that one. I was going to say, I think it depends on companies and environments and, businesses and so on, right? I think there are situations where the Google style cultures are probably wrong. Also, Google can afford, some aspects of their culture because of being a very wealthy company. It's not necessarily something I'd recommend everywhere to everyone. But actually, if you think of the fundamentals, the human fundamentals we talked about in the past, close to an hour, they're probably pretty universal, actually. So I think a lot of the traits we talked about so far, I think, is what I would consider the perfect culture.
Yeah, great. Now, listening to you, it's obvious. I mean, it's obvious when I look at your CV, but it's even more obvious and tangible listening to you now, Eric, that throughout your career, throughout your life, you developed yourself. So what do you do to develop yourself as a leader?
It's interesting. I mean, I think I brought up trainings, right? I'm sure some trainings here and there have had effect on me. I think the hands-on trainings more than others, but if I reflect on how I've grown and sort of figured out the things that we're talking about today, I think I still learn best like a baby, basically. It's by observing others doing something better than me, figuring out how they do it and imitating them and then getting better at it. So I think my biggest personal development periods in life were when I was usually paired with just someone that was much better than me at X or Y or Z. And I was like just impressed. And then, gradually like, how do they do this? Like, wow, why? And sometimes just by observing, sometimes of course talking to these people, right? And understanding from inside how they do things, etc., just figuring it out. And some things work for me, some things don't, right? I think we also have genes and there's moments where this isn't going to work for me and fine. But like there's others where like just learning that way worked well, which actually brings me to a specific point. I remember back in the day when we first had sort of the yearly, employee appraisal meetings, right? There were two boxes on the paper, strength and weaknesses. And we went through a period, some decades ago where, weaknesses was a bad word. So we started calling it areas for development.
Yeah.
And at the time I thought that was super smart because it's like, yeah, of course, it's not a weakness. It's something you can work on and do better, right? But then I remember meeting, I think it was some HR person who told me, no, I wished it stayed weaknesses because you don't necessarily need to just fix all your weaknesses. You are, as a human being, you are far more excited and capable of building on your strength than fixing your weaknesses. The same time spent making your strength better will lead like a 10x improvement versus, a 1.2x improvement on your weakness, and it'll be dreadful and so on and so on. So I think this is an interesting angle to the question you were asking about, which is you absolutely need to be aware of your weaknesses. Some of them are so fundamental that, yes, you'll need to work on X or Y or Z. But as a human, for yourself or the people in your team that you're trying to grow, think twice. You might just, have more fun and much better results by helping people who are good at something becoming great at something than necessarily trying to make them perfect on, on all axes of the 360 radar that we've all seen in these employee appraisals, right?
Yeah, brilliant. I could not agree more. Eric, it's been a super fun, super rewarding, rich conversation, a true pleasure listening to you and having this exchange with you. Coming to a closure, I'd like to share the floor with you again and give you the opportunity to share either a question or a message with these maybe 10, 12,000 people here listening to you right now in the LightWolf community. So in closing this, would you have a question or a message you'd like to share with these folks here?
Well, Stefan, first, I want to thank you very much for that opportunity. You've built an audience that is both quantitatively, but I'm sure also qualitatively very impressive. So I truly appreciate the time you've given me here as well.
A pleasure.
I think we very much share the same common goal, the two of us, but probably a lot of your listeners as well, of like making the world a better place. And, you know, I remember, can I use an anecdote maybe to answer your question?
Please.
So at one point in life, I was at the board of a fairly large standardization organization. So it's called GS1. It's basically the organization that standardizes all the barcodes in the world. So whenever you see a barcode, it was standardized by this organization.
They are all clients.
I was at the board, and whenever we started, you know, this is a big board. The people next to me were like CIOs, typically of Coca-Cola and Mattel and so on. And whenever we started the board, because this was a not-for-profit organization as a standards body, there was a lawyer that would come in and who spent 5 minutes reminding us, I was going to say brainwashing us, that you have to forget about your company, you have to forget about money, you have to forget about shareholders. You're here to make the world a better place. And the first time I went to that board meeting, I was sort of shocked and surprised. Isn't that obvious? And then I realized I'm incredibly fortunate that this is when I was at Google. You know, the rest of my life, my 99.9% of my time spent in my company, I was focused on making the world a better place, focused on the purpose. I wasn't worried about shareholder or money, et cetera. And it was an eye-opener to me that these people that I were working with, who were, you know, super competent senior people, very friendly, we had very good conversations about barcodes. Well, many of them, and I'd been in previous standardization bodies, you know, could easily have had their company's interest at heart, their shareholder, you know, interest at heart when they make these standards decisions instead of doing the right thing for the world. I didn't have that sort of schizophrenia because I was lucky to work in an organization that wasn't like that. And so I guess, you know, my hope, my message, and I think the younger generation is pushing all of us down that path, that the more we can, you know, live in and build companies and exercise leadership in ways that is purpose-driven and ideally a good purpose for the world, right? Making the world a better place. And boy, the world needs it these days. I think the better. Like we'll sleep better at night. You know, when our time will come, we'll look back at all these years and we'll feel good about what we've achieved. So that's what I'm hoping for the two of us, for all of you who are listening, for the world. Is like, you know, let's try and give more sense to what we're all trying to build and achieve here.
Awesome, dear Eric, an honor. A pleasure and just a terrific experience to have you here as my guest in this show. It's awesome. I'd love to continue our exchange. And for today, I just say a big, big thank you, Eric Tolomei.
Thank you.